lifting the veil between life and death. At some point, I might need a microphone because somewhere in that trip that I took a week ago, I picked up and brought home with me a bug from the south. And it's the bug's doing fine, y'all. I'm should be avoided like the plague. Before I left, I shared that I used to have a fear of flying, which of course was not completely true. It was really a fear of falling and crashing. Flying was never the problem. But I have hovered between life and death from time to time. My first experience was a falling experience. I was pushed out of an airplane when I was 15 years old. I did have a parachute, fortunately. Otherwise, from 8,000 feet, the results were not likely to be good. And why I was pushed out of the airplane at 15 years old is a really easy question to answer that all the males here will understand. My girlfriend's mother owned a skydiving club, and she asked if I wanted to go skydiving. And I said, sure, baby, I'm all man and afraid of nothing. That turned out not quite to be the case. And so when I climbed out there and with my feet on the wheels and my hands on the struts and looked down 8,000 feet with a sack of laundry on my back, and the guy said, let go, I wanted to negotiate, and it didn't really work out that well. And so in the time that it took, because I was on a static line, for that parachute to open, I was scared to death. My heart felt like it stopped, and life didn't really flash before me because I really didn't have much of a life at that point. But the anticipation of life flashed before me and everything I was going to miss. And it was probably 2 seconds, but it was an eternity. And what marked it was I probably was not in very much danger. Given that I was 15 years old and I drove out there with a 16-year-old driving, if you did the actuarial numbers, I was at more risk driving than falling. The next time I was hovering in the air was in an ER in San Francisco where I had been taken off a train with my throat closing. And your throat closing is really not a good career move. And they had intubated me on a cart. And before they intubated me, they hit me with what is medical curare without telling me the effect. So I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. But I was conscious. And just like Kubler-Ross says, I looked down at my body on the gurney. And I could see it, and I could see what I was wearing, and I could see that I could have lost some weight, could stand to lose some weight, and I believed that I was dead. What was interesting, and in Sherlock Holmes' way, what was significant was the dog that didn't bark. I thought I was dead, and I wasn't afraid. In that area, hovering between life and death, floating or falling or dreaming or thinking or fearing, our mortality is something that we visit, all of us, from time to time, and I think in different ways at different stages of our life. Mortality to us when we are young usually is an abstraction. It applies to others. Even for some who are older, the great line of William Saroyan as he was dying was, he said, I knew that death was inevitable, but I thought it would make an exception for me. That's really the attitude of youth. In middle age, I think many of us become afraid. And in older age, there seems to be a kind of acceptance of the fact that something ends here. I'll get to the ghosts and the goblins in a minute. Maybe I'll get to the ghosts and goblins now. Our attitude towards our mortality changes. But our ability to accept finality, I think, just changes in terms of our metaphors. When we see, I love Halloween. I love the kids in the costumes. I love the ghosts and the goblins, and that we invite all of these spirits and all of these kinds of incarnated fears out to play. And the idea that kids are really playing with the issue of mortality and playing with the idea of death is not a terrible thing. I like Halloween. I love going trick-or-treating I loved it with the kids, and I love it with the grandkids. But, you know, I like Day of the Dead even better than Halloween because I think it's healthier. What we do at Halloween, which is fine, is we invite our ghosts come by and we give them candy to go away. But there are other cultures, including the Day of the Dead, that takes a meal to the dead or invites them in. And I think that for most of us, inviting our ghosts in, getting nourishment from them, sharing time with them, is a healthier way of dealing with our fears. Having some fear around mortality certainly is reasonable. Mortality is something that we're all going to experience one way or another, and in terms of what happens next, I don't have a clue. I can tell you that in my professional capacity, as well as just my normal capacity as a human being, and as a son, I have been with people when they passed, or we use the term expire sometimes as a euphemism, but it's not really such a euphemism, because when you think of expire, it is that final breath, that final expiration. And if you are present for one of those moments, not as the star, but as a witness, you cannot help but wonder, where do we go? It's a universal intuition and perception, not simply a human neurotic thing of, well, we can't deal with our mortality, so we'll invent huge systems. I don't know that we invent huge systems. I think we invent metaphors for experiences that we can't put into words, and for the idea of peace that surpasses human understanding. And a mom that I know was asked, challenged, what about paradise with all those virgins? And his response in the beginning was very much like mine, which was, who said that 72 virgins is paradise? But he said, all of these things are metaphors, are poetry for a peace that is beyond our ability to understand or to language. So that's why even the very word paradise is a garden. The word pardesa from Persian means a garden. It's a place of peace and repose and plenty. Whatever plenty means in whatever happens next. And again, at these prices, you don't get an answer to what happens next. You get to build your own metaphors and to think about and feel about what is nourishing to us. One of the things that has always struck me, and particularly when I'm seeing previews of movies that I will not ever see, with all of the ghouls and the goblins and the zombies and all of those other creatures, and it's all fine, it's just not a movie that I want to spend a lot of time with, is that we try to handle our fears by visualizing them and by, in a way, inviting them in. That's what I think these zombie movies are about. We go and visit these projections, and we also have an idea that, well, whatever happens, we're not quite done when we think we're done. We can't, and many people have attempted to argue this on a rational basis, and that's fine, that we can't just be here and that's it. Well, I'm not sure that we can't just be here and that's it, because for me, being here and that's it is more comforting than actually spending eternity as a zombie, which may be a metaphor for certain political movements, but we're not going to go there. The idea, to me, is that our ghosts and our goblins, for most of us, are blessed visitors, are things that we should and do welcome in. That the idea of however it is that we build mansions for them in another life is something that we have always done, whether it was the Greek version of the Elysian Fields or the Persian Pardesa pleasure gardens or hymns and harps in the sky. We try to put people in some comfortable place. And part of that is for our own comfort and projection, but part of it is so that they will be more accessible to us and not gone. I have, at moments when I have been present for people passing, expiring, noted something that happened to me on that table in the ER in San Francisco, and that was an absence of fear and even some humor. I remember my oldest friend Tom's mother was dying, and we were in the room and holding her hand, and she was a Southern girl, and she was a hardcore non-believer, but she said, "I'll put in a good word for you with the captain on the other side. Make sure you get a good table." Now, and then she closed her eyes and breathed her last breath. Now, what's important here? One, the absence of fear. Two, the intuition that you close your eyes here and open them somewhere else. Is it true? I don't know. But it's an intuition that I had. When I was floating above myself in that room, I wondered, well, this is interesting. John, you're dead. I wonder how long consciousness lasts. I wonder what happens next. I don't see a tunnel. I just see that body there. It was a sense of wonderment. Occasionally, people other than professional comedians will be funny on a deathbed. Sean's aunt, Wendy, my sister-in-law, when she was dying, we were gathered around her, and she's a good Unitarian, a member of the Unitarian Church in Kaneo Valley, and her husband, a good Unitarian, is there and stroking her hands and saying, "Wherever you go, my sweetheart, I will find you." And that's sweet and commendable, and I completely understand it. And then he said to her, "Sweetheart, it's okay. You can let go now. It's okay. You can let go." She opened up her eyes and said, "I'm trying." So we all collapsed in laughter. And then the laughter turned to tears and then back to laughter. My ambition as a ghost is to be nourishing. My ambition as a preacher or teacher is for us to be able to invite the mystery in. Whatever the dreams and the fantasies and the metaphors that we make, and the poet said it best, you know, the thing of beauty is a joy forever. And we talk about the mighty dooms that we have imagined for the mighty dead. All lovely words that we have spoken and read. Whatever they are the way that we try to handle their mortality and our own. There are always two principles at any memorial service or funeral. The person being honored and remembered, and all of us, because we're brought face to face with that sense of fragility of this precious miracle. And just to really go off the deep end here, when people talk about their metaphors, their heavens, their destinies, whatever they are, and I want to sit there and say, well, how likely is that? Then I think about today. And I think about this day, this life, and each of us, and how likely is any of this? How likely in this enormous universe, possibly multiverse, for any of us to be alive, for any of us to be sitting in this room, for any of us to have the ability to think and to wonder and to worship and to weep and do all of those things that we do. It is unlikely to a degree that I cannot begin to do the math with, even with a computer. We are all the great beneficiaries of a cosmic role of carbon-based life. And we have these moments, at least we know, and we have these moments that are so hugely improbable. And what happened before we were born, the old Zen koan, I don't know. What happens after we are not here, I don't know. What happens while we're here is, I think, to make the kinds of choices, as our opening reading indicated, that makes our world a little better, a little happier, that builds a legacy so that when we are the ghosts that are remembered, when our spirits are in the hearts and the memories as well as the DNA of the people who come after us, that it will be a nourishing, inspirational part of other lives. Every day is a miracle. And death and mortality, I think, only remind us of how precious this miracle is. If we live forever, we could take a decade or two off. But as far as we know, we don't. So we need to act as if this day counts, as if this smile, this hug, this piece of food that we give to somebody, this sense of respect that we give to somebody makes a difference and lights and warms just a little piece of real estate in a universe whose size is beyond human imagining and where our world floats like a dust mote in the void of night. And we can keep each other good company as we float through these precious, beautiful moments.